In the Iliad, it's the Trojan commander Hector who wields the sword that kills Patroclus. But our hero, Achilles, is the one devastated, torn apart not simply by grief, but by a guilt he cannot shake, that he failed to protect his best friend. That epic poem was written nearly 3,000 years ago, but it demonstrates that people in the time of Homer were familiar with what mental health experts now call moral injury. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Moral injury still doesn't have an official place in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, where you can find listings for other trauma-related illnesses like PTSD. It's only been the subject of study since the late 20th century. Now, folks looking to help people suffering from it are reporting a spike in occurrence related not to war and violence, but the COVID-19 pandemic, which left some overwhelmed healthcare workers unable to provide as much care as their patients needed. Elizabeth Svoboda is a science writer whose recent article for Scientific American was titled, "Moral Injury is an Invisible Epidemic That Affects Millions." Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's wonderful to be here.
One pioneering expert on moral injury, the theologian Rita Nakashima Brock, describes it as a kind of identity crisis. What does she mean by that?
Well, I think when she says identity crisis, she's referring to this big disconnect that happens. We all have our own personal code of ethics, of morals, the way we like to see ourselves. We're a person that behaves justly, we're a person that gives of ourselves to the best of our ability. Where the disconnect comes in is if in a difficult moment you're not able to be that person for one reason or another. So it really is fundamentally an identity thing. You think or you hope that you can be a certain way morally, and in whatever situation you're in, you end up falling short.
What do people who have suffered moral injuries say it feels like? How does it affect somebody day to day?
Well, I think oftentimes it can be stemming from like a one-time cataclysmic event. Like, let's say you're a doctor and you have a patient that dies on the operating table. That could affect you for many years. But over and over, what I've heard from people who have experienced this, especially in healthcare, is that it can really feel like a death by a thousand cuts. It's not necessarily just one event that causes the moral injury. It's just this knowledge that every day you're in an environment and you're in circumstances where you're falling short of being able to meaningfully help people or carry out your role or your vocation the way you know you can do. And so that can make it really difficult, I think, to heal, because it's almost as if the injury is happening over and over again. And each of those injuries may not be a big one, but over time, there's a huge cumulative effect.
Right. And there's just not a chance, depending on what you do for a living, to stop down and really allow yourself to process all this.
Exactly. In medicine, there's definitely a culture of overwork, of because this job is my vocation, oftentimes my calling, I am going to go above and beyond any kind of reasonable expectations. And what that crowds out is the time you need to think and process, hey, what happened to me the other day when somebody with COVID came to my hospital and I wasn't able to admit them because we simply didn't have any beds. I called around, there weren't any beds in any of the other hospitals in the region, and there was quite simply nothing I could do for this person, and I had to send them away. And that goes against every moral impulse that led me to this career in the first place.
Right. So this brings us to the sort of shadow epidemic of moral injury that's occurred along with the pandemic. What did you hear from ER Dr. Tori McGowan about what made the worst days of COVID so much harder than just long hours or severely sick patients or the kinds of things that any ER doctor would be expected to sort of handle in the course of a regular career?
Right. Well, there were several layers to it, really, when I was shadowing Dr. McGowan. There was this basic problem of resources. She did not have enough beds to admit people that, in her professional opinion, seriously needed treatment. Their oxygen levels might have been plummeting, and she basically had to send them home and say, if it gets worse, try coming back in a day or two. And having to say that to patients that were visibly struggling in front of her was so difficult for her. But the other level of it was, I think, that she also felt a betrayal because there were some patients coming into the hospital that if she came into the room and she told them, hey, you have COVID, they would, without a mask on, going against hospital policy, they would start cursing her out, tell her COVID doesn't exist, or things like, I don't care if I get you sick, I don't care if I get anyone else sick. And so I think she had kind of felt her whole career that she was part of this moral contract that she would do her utmost to help the people in her care, and that in return, they would at least treat her humanely. And I think she felt that during COVID, that basic reciprocity was really breaking down. And I think that was one of the things that surprised me talking to her. I hadn't foreseen that aspect of it, but I could tell that that was affecting her just as much, if not more, as the resource problems and not being able to admit or treat patients properly.
Yeah, it seems really impossible not to start taking those kinds of verbal attacks and that kind of disrespect personally.
Yes, and I had some conversations with her about that, and she really emphasized that she was trying so hard to separate what she was actually in control of, what she was able to do, from how other people respond. And I think a lot of us have tried to do that kind of separation when we're in situations where a lot of it feels out of our control, but sometimes it sounds good in theory, but in the moment, when you're in an exam room that's 10 feet by 10 feet and somebody with COVID is yelling at you and they don't have a mask on and you have an immunocompromised husband at home, it's really hard just to confine your thinking to, okay, what do I have control over here? And it can be helpful, but it doesn't necessarily lessen the trauma that you're facing in that moment.
And this maybe speaks to the other side of moral injury. On the one hand, there is dealing with whatever lapses or failures you think you may have been responsible for. On the other side, there is, looking at the entire world, and maybe it's not as moral or as just or as good a place as you were able to believe it was.
Yes, exactly. Again, it's this disconnect that comes up. A lot of people, especially in healthcare, especially in professions like teaching and law, there's a whole lot of idealism in those fields. And I think a lot of people got into those careers hoping that they could be part of contributing to making what they saw as an essentially just and good world even more just, even more fair, that they could be part of a movement in the right direction. And when they see things going so topsy-turvy that they can't even perceive a movement in the right direction anymore, I think especially for those idealistic people, it can hit especially hard.
This really made me think about the way, Elizabeth, our culture has, it feels as if it's gotten meaner or it's become more acceptable for us to be very cruel to people we may not know personally. People, if we encounter them online, we might say terrible things to them, even if we've never met them.
Yes, it's very true. And I think in this online environment where what gets rewarded are the one-liners, what gets rewarded are the pile-ons, what does not get rewarded, in fact, what might get downvoted is any kind of nuanced perception of who this other person actually is and whether, well, they made this one decision, they said this one thing. Maybe that doesn't comprise the totality of who this person is. And I think when we get used to engaging in that kind of behavior online, absolutely, it can carry over to our everyday lives. And I think some somebody like Tori McGowan would really be on the butt end of that when she would l listen to these rants from patients coming in that had been absorbing conspiracy theories online and essentially started to see her, the person who was most trying to help them, as the enemy. And so it's just a very essentializing way of looking at people that leaves no room for anybody else's humanity.
Awareness of moral injury didn't start with health workers. How did modern scholars begin to identify its effects in members of the military coming back home?
Well, I think as people started to come home from Vietnam, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, what a lot of therapists, especially in the Veterans Affairs system, started to notice was that they were having people on the tail end of their deployments come in for therapy, come in again, and come in again. And this could stretch on for years. And these people just did not seem to be getting better. Maybe they were receiving treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it just didn't really seem to be helping. And there was one therapist in the Veterans Affairs, Brett Litz, who really was one of the first ones to take a closer look at this and say, hey, these people are stuck in some kind of stagnant grief that they can't get out of. And it really seems like this is a moral thing. It's not necessarily something that they get scared of fireworks because it sounds like gunshots. It's not related to anything like that. It is, as you were saying earlier, an identity crisis. This break in this relationship that you have with yourself, where you could trust yourself to be a good person, you could trust the world to be fundamentally good. For a lot of these veterans, that had just completely fallen apart for them. And Litz was really one of the pioneering researchers in starting to define the concept of moral injury in more detail. He wrote some key papers that I think increased awareness among other therapists that this was actually a framework that could be helpful, especially in dealing with patients that had come back from wars, that had come back from other kinds of traumatic experiences, that maybe in a lot of cases, moral injury was at the heart of this, and that you needed to help people reckon with what had happened, and that it wasn't enough to say, oh, you should just move on. Maybe you're having distorted thoughts about this. The fact was that a lot of them weren't having distorted thoughts. They were pretty realistic with themselves about the kinds of awful things that they might have seen or been involved in. And so any kind of helpful therapy needed to help them work through, okay, this is what I really did. This is what I experienced. Am I going to make some kind of amends? Am I going to do something specific to help me reorient myself, like move in a way that I feel like I'm able to contribute to the world again and be the person morally that I see myself as and hope that I can be.
Elizabeth, a number of soldiers who came back from wars suffering from what used to be called shell shock. I think when we all learned about PTSD a number of years ago, we assumed they all had PTSD. It sounds like our growing understanding of moral injury suggests maybe some of them, in fact, were suffering from moral injury and not PTSD, or possibly a combination of the two.
Yes, that is absolutely the case. Moral injury can overlap with PTSD, but it also may not. With PTSD, I think it typically gets established when you're in a situation where your life is threatened or your safety is threatened, which is something that, of course, we see a lot in war zones. But I think when Brett Litz was talking to these vets who year after year were not getting better, he realized that what they were facing didn't really have to do with any kind of threat to their lives. It was more this disparity between the morals that they were trained in, the morals that they wanted to live by, and what they had been involved in, whether it involved killing a civilian, whether it involved being involved with somebody locally on the ground who was then later killed because of their high visibility, communicating with an American soldier. So those kind of events where the soldiers had a really hard time forgiving themselves for what happened, that is moral injury as distinct from PTSD.
A lot of people are aware that scientists have discovered some sort of hallmarks within the brain of an illness like PTSD. What does moral injury look like from a neurobiological perspective?
Yes, the studies on this are still somewhat limited, but what we do see so far is that moral injury does have different signatures within the brain than PTSD. With people with moral injury, what we see is more activity in the area of the brain called the precuneus, which is involved in just making moral judgments. And with people who only have PTSD, we don't see that. And we also see different ways the brain metabolizes glucose in the brain of somebody who is experiencing what's called moral threat versus somebody who has only experienced a more physical threat to their life. So these distinctions are just starting to be made, and we definitely need to see more research here, but some important differences are already coming to the fore.
Moral injury doesn't have an official place in the DSM, which is also often described as this kind of Bible of mental health diagnoses. Does that just mean that it's too new, or do the people studying this think it's functionally something different than mental illnesses as they're typically defined?
Right. One interesting thing that came up in conversations that I was having with healthcare providers, with psychologists, was that with moral injury, some of them didn't really see it as a pathological or a diseased response. They said, hey, moral injury is actually a very understandable and very human response to being in a situation where, say, you made a mistake that caused someone else to lose their life, or when day after day you're in a situation where resource constraints mean that you just can't do your job the way you were trained to do it. And when you're in these impossible situations, people told me it really, when moral injury happens, it is very normal. It's actually probably very healthy that you're having this response because it is very disturbing that you can't live up to your values.
Of course, that doesn't mean that it isn't excruciating to experience. And it turns out it's often really hard for people who are suffering with moral injury to talk about the event or the conditions that caused that injury. What have you learned about how people try to cope before they seek help or even realize they might be able to get help for this?
Right. I think because there hasn't been a lot of awareness of the concept of moral injury at all, people just really don't understand the nature of what it is they're facing. All they see is that they did something or saw something that went so much against their morals that they maybe have spent years or even decades blaming themselves for what happened. They might see themselves as this irredeemable person, which is, of course, really not the case at all, but that is the conception that they have. And so certainly that could lead you into alcohol use disorders, other types of addictive responses. And a lot of what we see in veterans, higher rates of depression, higher rates of suicide, higher rates of drug addiction, a lot of that, not all of it, but a good portion, is probably at least partially traceable to the moral injury that they've experienced.
Does moral injury respond to the kinds of treatments often offered to people who have things that might look similar, anxiety or depression or PTSD?
That depends. It's actually a healthy debate, I think, in the psychology field right now. Is something like cognitive behavioral therapy, which is generally the frontline treatment for somebody who's depressed, somebody who's anxious, is that good enough for somebody facing moral injury? And with Cognitive behavioral therapy, the way it generally works is the therapist works with you to try to identify if you have any distortions in your thought patterns. Like if you're blaming yourself maybe inappropriately for something that happened, maybe they can help you to have a new thought that you resonate with that is maybe closer to reality that is going to put you on a mentally healthier path. But some people also think that something like cognitive behavioral therapy may not be good enough for somebody facing moral injury because in a lot of cases they may not be having distorted thoughts per se. They may be having pessimistic thoughts, but given some of the horrible things that they saw or went through or even perpetrated, some of their thoughts may actually be very realistic. And so some of the new treatment approaches that are being developed for moral injury specifically are not about retraining your thoughts so much as they're about encouraging you to reckon with what really happened. Like if you really did something against your moral code, helping you to face up to that and then ask yourself the question, okay, in the face of what happened, in the face of what I did that I can't change, how can I strike a path going forward that is gonna make me feel like I can be a moral person again and that I can be the kind of contributor that I want to be? And so it's really facing what happened head on. And I feel like that is extremely important and can get people out of these sort of frozen states that in some cases they've been in for years.
Understandably, spiritual leaders, imams, priests, rabbis, pastors, are concerned about the mental well-being of their congregations, in every case. This one, though, has a particularly interesting element to it. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how spiritual leaders are trying to address these problems in ways that may be different from what a strictly mental health professional would do.
Yes, I think with a traditional therapeutic relationship, you have a pretty big power differential. Like you have the therapist who is trained to treat you in a certain way, and you have you. And certainly a lot of people do make great progress in therapy, but there's not necessarily the degree of nuanced human understanding as there can be in a relationship with your pastor, with your imam, who in some cases you've been building a relationship with for many years. They know you as a whole person, the good and the bad. You don't just come into their office to talk about the worst things that happened to you. They're also privy to all the other elements of your life, the range of things that make you a full-fledged human being. And so what psychiatrists and psychologists, I think, are starting to realize is that through collaborating with members of the clergy, whether it's chaplains, ministers, rabbis, that people can engage with those providers on such a human level. And these clergy are just so experienced in emoting and having the kind of empathy and human understanding that you can't necessarily find in every single doctor's office. And so some people that may not be able to heal in a traditional therapeutic setting, they may be on the best path to healing if one of those clergy is involved.
Just to be really clear for folks, moral injury, though, is not limited to people of faith because human morality is not limited to people who believe in a deity or deities.
Absolutely. That is absolutely true. And if you're not a person of faith, I think certainly you could talk with somebody else who is close to you, possibly a family member who, let's say you're a veteran, maybe you have somebody else who's a veteran in your family who you know has faced similar things and you really trust them because, as I think you were alluding to earlier, it can be so difficult to talk about the events that gave rise to the moral injury, it can be triggering, it can stir up so much. And so anybody that you can talk to, that you feel safe with, that you feel like they're not going to judge you in that moment, that is a really important foundation for being able to reckon with what happened and it eventually move forward and set a direction that's healthy for you.
This article, Elizabeth, made me think about the fact that our culture loves to call people heroes, and I think we mean that really sincerely, right? Doctors and nurses who are working in healthcare facilities through the pandemic, soldiers and firefighters and police officers, even, you know, frontline workers in places like grocery stores. We tell these folks they're heroes, and I think we do that as a great compliment. I wonder if our expectation, though, the way we sort of feed that idea of people, increases the hazard that something will happen that causes them to question this.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. And I don't think that we mean to do this at all, but sometimes by banging that hero drum over and over again, I feel like we set the standards so high for these healthcare providers, for these frontline workers. And so it becomes easier and easier for them to feel like they can't measure up to this almost inhuman heroism standard. And so, and the other thing that we see, I think during the pandemic, we had people in our neighborhood go out and clapping, banging drums for people involved in healthcare. But as the pandemic stretched on, I think a lot of that acknowledgement and a lot of that support sort of dropped off. And I heard people say to me, you know, what I'm facing now is almost just as bad as what I faced 2 years ago. And yet everybody in society wants to pretend that it's time to move on from this pandemic. And I feel like nobody is even looking or caring about the struggles that I'm facing.
So if one treatment that does seem effective is helping people make meaningful amends for the things they feel they've done wrong or the ways they feel they have failed, what are some ways this can happen with, you know, if COVID and COVID care is the source of someone's moral injury? You can't fix somebody who died because there weren't resources to care for them in the moment.
Yes. And oftentimes this making amends, it's not going to be 100% solution. It's often a partial thing. Like if there's a specific case where you weren't able to treat a child because you weren't able to admit them, you could consider writing a letter to that family and expressing your sorrow that you weren't able to do more in that moment. And that other person may or may not want to engage with you there, but it may help you feel like at least I did what I could to acknowledge that I was not the person I wanted to be in that moment. And I made myself vulnerable there. And maybe I can get a little bit of closure because I've fully acknowledged and I've tried to make my amends to people. But I think sometimes it's not about apologizing or about trying to right every perceived wrong that you've committed, but finding a sense of purpose going forward. Like, even if I saw this or I did this or I was involved in this, what is my purpose going to be? And what are the daily things that I can do that are in line with that? And so I think that is part of the moving forward too. Sometimes there is an apology, or sometimes, you know, people might donate money to support, say, civilians hurt by a war that they were involved in, or things like that, anything that feels personally meaningful. But if you don't have that clear sense of purpose going forward that is in line with your values, I think that you're not going to be able to move forward at your best.
Are there any good estimates of how common moral injury is in this country?
A lot of the estimates are very sketchy at this point. There have only been a limited number of surveys carried out. I would feel safe saying that it would certainly be in the millions in this country alone. There are some studies that among K through 12 school professionals, including teachers, more than half of those people have faced the kind of situations that would be expected to cause moral injury. And similarly, in healthcare, it's typically about half of physicians when you answer surveys that are affected. So huge numbers.
Do we have any idea, do scientists have any idea, Elizabeth, why, as with PTSD, two people can have the same experience and one may be severely affected by a moral injury while another seems to come out with their emotional well-being relatively intact?
That's an excellent question, and I think we still don't fully understand the answer from a scientific perspective. But I think one aspect is how you feel about what happened. Let's say if you kill somebody and you feel completely justified in having done that, you may not experience a moral injury at all from having killed that person. But if you killed somebody in a situation where you absolutely feel like that killing goes against your moral code, you are going to be a lot more likely to suffer in ways that the first person might not. So I think a key question to ask is how big is the disconnect between what happened, what you did, what you experienced, and your personal moral code? And I think the bigger the space between those two things, probably the more likely you're going to see significant moral injury.
From the outside, I think many of us could look at, say, a grocery store employee forced to go into work every day while others worked from home and see that they're not morally responsible for, say, bringing home the virus to their families. It's a terrible situation. In some cases, people just didn't have any other choice. Why is that sort of logic so hard to access when you're the person dealing with the moral injury around an event like that?
Right. Well, I think it just feels so visceral. If you were that frontline grocery store worker who, maybe you took your mask off to eat lunch one day, and then you bring home COVID-19 to your kid who has asthma and is immunocompromised, somebody telling you from outside that, look, you were in an impossible situation, you couldn't have done anything different, oftentimes that is not going to resonate with the mother or father whose child is suffering. And so they will continue to put that guilt on themselves, even if from a logical perspective, we can recognize how they were in a structural situation that just was making this almost impossible for them to do what they perceive as the right thing.
How aware are employers and organizations these days of the potential hazards of moral injury for their workers?
I think the awareness is growing, which is a wonderful thing, but I also think there's a lot longer way to go. What I heard over and over again from healthcare providers is that if I'm continually being put in a situation, my employer, where I'm not getting the resources I need to do my job properly, I'm gonna keep getting morally injured over and over again. And so they said what we need to have is these internal discussions within, whether it's health systems, school districts, law firms, about how do we make sure that we're not putting our employees in a position to fail over and over again in ways that are often not their fault? And are there changes that we can make to get people out of the path of moral injury, or at least less likely to suffer it?
And unfortunately, it seems a lot of companies are responding to this with kind of the simplest solution, which may not be effective, like self-care stuff like yoga sessions or free massages or meals. Those things are nice to have and they might be good for stress, but stress and moral injury are not the same thing.
Exactly. It can't just be about bringing in one of these outside wellness providers on contract. I actually had one ER doctor tell me, like, if I have to listen to another one of these, you got to eat well, you got to sleep well, you got to do yoga. If I have to listen to another one of these conversations from management, I'm going to throw up, because people rightly see it as just a band-aid solution that is not going to change the structural factors that are actually giving rise to the moral injury in the first place. Like, if you watch somebody die in front of you and you get a massage, it's not going to change the fact that somebody died in front of you.
Given the fact that this is a relatively recent diagnosis, how aware are mental health professionals that moral injury might in fact be the source of their patient's distress?
It's a really good question. Again, I think awareness is growing, but if you go to any given healthcare provider, I think there's not a guarantee that they are going to understand what it means, that they are going to have read the literature on the topic, because most of the literature is a decade old or even less. And so sometimes I think if a client or a patient becomes aware or resonates with this concept that I think this is what happened to me, I think I'm morally injured, the patient may need to be the one to start the dialogue with the provider. Like, look, I've been reading about moral injury. Take a look at this paper. Do you think that this is what could be going on with me? And that if you're dealing with a healthcare provider that is not that familiar with the concept, that that can be a learning experience for the provider as well, and that they can take that knowledge into dealings with other patients who may be morally injured as well.
What does the moral injury event scale measure exactly?
It measures the severity of the events that you might have faced that could cause moral injury. As we said earlier, not every potentially morally injurious event, as they call them, causes moral injury in everyone, but it's sort of a rule of thumb, like how often are you exposed to these events? How severe are these events? What kind of events are they? So it's just kind of a quick sum up, like how much at risk are you probably of being in a moral injury space?
Are there hallmark symptoms that people can look out for if they suspect they might be affected by a moral injury?
I think guilt may be a primary one. Like if you are dealing with guilt about something that you did or something that you saw, whether it was last week, 5 years ago, 5 decades ago, that might be a red flag. Like if you are beating up on yourself over and over again for doing something or failing to do something, and you just feel like, I'm irredeemable now, there's no way that anybody could ever view me as a moral person again, those kinds of thoughts, that kind of inner dialogue is what should really raise the red flags.
What is adaptive disclosure?
That is one of the newer moral injury therapies that the psychologist Brett Litz has helped develop. And the idea at the heart of it is that you really face the ethical issue that's bothering you head on. Like you engage with it, even though it might feel really scary. Like the therapist might encourage you to accept or to voice out loud a truth that feels uncomfortable. Like, yes, I did lead that attack on Iraqi civilians and somebody died. Or to put it in a healthcare context, yes, I sent those suffering patients home without treatment. And so I think once you establish that baseline of forthrightness, of facing up to what really happened, from there, the therapist can help you figure out how to make amends, how to get some kind of closure, and how to move forward in a way that is more in tune with your values and with the kind of person that you want to be.
Is group therapy a technique that's being used to help people with moral injury?
Yes, definitely. And there's a lot of that going on at the Shea Moral Injury Center in Washington, D.C., which is run by Volunteers of America, which is an organization that a lot of people are probably familiar with. And they are really pioneers in starting these group therapy programs where people with moral injury get to meet up, build relationships, and talk with people who they know have been in the same kind of impossible moral situations, faced the same kinds of difficult choices as they have. And so I think there's a feeling of ease, a feeling of comfort that you can get with other people who have gone through that crucible that you can't necessarily get with anybody else, and that building those relationships over time, there are support groups that are online, there are support groups that are in person, can really be a key part of helping you reestablish yourself as a person who is living for something, is dedicated to a moral code, and is committed to getting the kind of results that they want to see in the world. That having that support is such a big part of that journey.
Did you hear from folks, Elizabeth, who were thinking about leaving their professions because the compounding effects of moral injury just started to feel unbearable?
Yes, definitely. I talked to people who debated that almost every single day. And I think one of the difficult factors psychologically was that they just didn't see an end to what was going on, especially in healthcare. A couple of months after I did my initial reporting, I checked back in with Tori McGowan, and I was hoping that since the COVID case counts had gone down a little bit in her area, that she might say, "Oh, I'm getting a little bit of relief. I'm getting a chance to think about things more." But she said, "No, I really don't feel that way because other people are quitting in droves. And so for those of us that are left, we're still in the same kind of impossible situation, not having enough resources, not being able to treat people the way we need to because we're just stretched way too thin." And that continues even when there are dips in the case numbers in the pandemic. And so I think in a way it's like having a prison sentence that doesn't have a definitive end time. And that is just, we know that that is one of the most difficult things psychologically for humans.
So if we don't find a way as a society to acknowledge and address this, it's just going to keep getting worse for people.
Yes, I think if we don't address it now, if we keep kicking the can down the road, the consequences, psychological, in terms of do we have a viable healthcare workforce, those consequences are just going to keep snowballing. So I think for healthcare organizations, for school districts, for law firms, for so many organizations, it really is in their best interests to reckon with this problem now, to have meetings involving employees about what's really going on with you. And before you make any policy changes from the top, have conversations with people within the organization about, is this going to make doing your job harder? Is this going to contribute to moral injury because you're not able to administer the tests you want to administer? You're not able to teach a child in a way that's going to reach them because you were constrained to a particular kind of state curriculum. Things like that, they have to be addressed because if they're not, all of these fields are going to be at risk of losing many of their best and most dedicated employees.
If people recognize this and feel like maybe they need some help for their own moral injury, do you have quick thoughts on how we can find someone who might be qualified to help us deal with this?
Yes, I mean, I think a lot of veterans affairs psychologists in particular, you could probably trust that they are going to be familiar with moral injury because they are going to have had clients who have grappled with that. So they're going to have direct experience in treating that kind of injury. But I mean, I would say you can even, if you're feeling brave, take a dive into the scientific literature and just look, who are the psychologists that are at the front lines of this research, and do they also see patients? And it's worth taking a few minutes to do those kind of inquiries because who you get in that therapeutic relationship with when you're morally injured and doing the kind of disclosure you need to do requires an immense amount of courage. You want to make sure you have somebody who's absolutely equipped to help you through that the best they can.
Elizabeth Svoboda is a science writer. Her recent article for Scientific American was titled "Moral Injury is an Invisible Epidemic That Affects Millions." Elizabeth, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. Do sign up for our podcast, which you can find wherever you get podcasts, or at our website, think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.